Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. Got a great show for you tonight.
Yay.
It's an interesting one because it's dealing with a group that I think influenced me a lot in terms of tone and playing. And blues, especially the blues. And I know it influenced my guest host tonight, Don Butler. Welcome,
hey,
Don.
Thank you.
And I'm going to announce all the guests that are on because we've got a bunch of people. And then I want to dedicate the show to Twiggs Linden, who was the original manager for the Allman Brothers.
Tour manager.
And let the guys reminisce and tell us maybe a couple of quick stories about that, and then we'll get on with the show. But anyway, I want to welcome first Jack Weston and Willie Perkins, who wrote this killer book on Allman Brothers memorabilia. And my favorite part's chapter one, where it's all the equipment and all the gear, because I'm a gearhead. But it has all this other stuff about, you know, they have everything, the shirts, the artwork, all of the different things, and I love it that somebody still has that Anvil case or that Rode case that says Live at the Fillmore. They actually stenciled that for the album cover. I think that's just very cool. But anyway, the two writers, Jack Weston and Willie Perkins, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yay!
And then,
thanks. Thanks for having us. Great.
And thirdly, but not last, the guy who actually restored Dickie Betts' Bassman amp, the original, they found the bass. We're going to talk about that whole story. But he came in, Skip Simmons. He's known for amp restoration, especially vintage stuff and especially Fenders, which is good because I got Don here too, and he's both Fender and Marshall. So it'll be a very interesting. We'll talk a little bit about that, the restoration, what it took, what condition it was in. And a little bit about when you should do when you need stuff done, like recapping. There's a lot of pros and cons. You know, do you need to do this? Should you just do this or wait until it blows out? Or, but anyway, real quick though, welcome everybody for being on the show. And any quick reminiscences about Twiggs? Tell me a little bit about Twiggs since we're dedicating the show to him.
Well, Twiggs was the original tour manager for the band. He more or less discovered the group. He was sent up to Alabama, where Muscle Shoals, where Dwayne was a session guitarist, by Phil Walden, the head of Capricorn Records.
Mm-hmm.
And he was instrumental in getting them signed, and he ran into a little problem in New York with the law enforcement authorities, and
sleazy club
went away for a little while. And I won't go into detail with it. It's a long story. But he had always told me if anything ever happened to him, he was going to tell the band to call me. and let me take his place. And I got a phone call in April of 1970, and within by June 1st, I was the tour manager. And later, Twiggs got all his problems straightened out, and he came back to the band in the but he worked on equipment and production, and I stayed the road manager for the whole what we call the golden era, when Dwayne and Barry were alive up through 1976. So at that point, I had 6 years with them.
Now, when you first met them, when you first were working with them, they were did Dwayne have his infamous Marshall at that time, or was he basically just using Fender? Were they all using Fender amps at that time?
They got into the Marshalls pretty quick after they originally had a lot of Fender amps and some Sun, and then they got into the Marshalls pretty quickly though.
Oh, okay. So they did have their own Sun amps. Do you guys never now at that time? Because we have to remember this was years ago. It was a lot different than it is now, where a lot of groups now they'll just bring a pedal board and guitars, and all the amps are supplied to them for each venue from different music houses. But back then, they carried all their own equipment, right? They never.
Everybody bought, carried.
Yeah,
yeah,
they did. I talked to Kim Payne, one of the roadies, and they had their own equipment. Well, if you look in the book, there's like a vinyl amp cover that stenciled Allman Brothers. They basically phased those out probably by the middle at the latest of 1970. So that indicates to me, when I was talking to Kim Payne, they were carrying all that stuff on the road with them. First out of a Econoline, then they gravitated to they called it the Windbag, but it was a Winnebago.
Mm-hmm.
And then, they just continued on and ultimately got their own plane, but... Willie can tell you about that, but they were using, to answer your question, they were pretty much really using their own gear and bringing it on.
Yeah, one
on
of the
around the country.
One of the first illustrations in our book is a invoice where they received their first batch of equipment on a line of credit from a couple of crazy music store guys who believed in them, and they got about. $13,000 worth of equipment on the cup, and they paid it off. But I'm looking at it right now, and it shows some Marshall speaker cabinets, some Sun speaker cabinets, some JBL speakers.
There's some Showmans on there, I think, and then they got the basement
twin.
Amps. Yeah.
Now,
yeah, so they had Marshall's speaker cabinets from the get-go.
Now, did they just mix and match all of their amps, or did they specifically use certain amps how did they set up? Because you got a lot of different amps here. Did they just stack them all together, similar to like Hendrix, where he would use, or were they consciously
lots
using,
of Y cables?
Yeah, I mean, were they doing it?
They were using Y cables. I've been told that. Yeah, Don's right.
But what I mean was, like Hendrix would use some of the. I think it was he was using Sun
and Marshall.
And Marshall to get the low end from the Sun, and he was so he was trying to modify the sound to get a little fuller sound. Were they doing that, or they were just using what just more volume, or to put out for the audience?
Well, there was a lot of volume, I'll tell you that. I think that there was a lot of experimenting going on, and again, I'm not the expert on equipment, but pretty much they were just experimenting with different equipment and sounds. I know the sound board guy would make suggestions, and then Dwayne was always experimenting, and they were making modifications. Greg had his
the B3.
Leslie Tone cabinets. He had them souped up, and as the band progressed, they were always mixing and matching and experimenting.
Well, speaking of modifications, this is one of the things I had mentioned to Jack when I met him on the phone, and I was talking just before the show with Don. So let's bring it up, because you just mentioned that you had invoices for Sirwin Vega speakers. One of the things we were talking about that I had heard a long time ago, and I think it was in Guitar Player magazine or something, but When they were touring, when you know the original in those days, Marshalls were kind of rare. There weren't a lot around, and very expensive. And when you blew the speakers, it was really hard to get Celestians. They were not as readily available today, like you can get at almost every guitar store.
Right.
And so I had always heard that when they blew their speakers, they replaced them. And the rumor was that Duane had replaced them with JBLs, and it altered the sound. The same thing happened with Clapton when he was touring with Cream. When he blew his speakers out, they replaced them with, you know, JBLs, because that was readily available. They couldn't get the Celestians, and it changed the sound a lot. Now, Don, I want Don to talk a little more about that, but I had heard that was a key element in how their sound, because it didn't sound like a norm, you know, like a typical Marshall.
No, well, you know, you also have to bear in mind that Duane, towards, you know, when they finally got the gear together, was using 250-watt bass Marshall bass heads.
Mm-hmm.
And Dickie was using a 100-watt Marshall lead. Both of them used 2/4-12 cabs. Duane used to use Sirwin Vega ER-123s, as he knew Lois and Gene Sirwinski from the Hourglass days. So they kind of hooked up, and, you know, everybody at Sirwin Vega was a huge fan in those days. I mean, there was only like 12 of us.
Mm-hmm. So he just had, he would use those. And then Dickie was the one that actually was using the, he did use JBLs?
Dickie to this day uses JBLs.
Okay.
But I remember when Chuck started with the band, his keyboard rig was louder than Dickie's, and it pissed Dickie off to no end. And Betts' mind was like, well, if I get these, I'll be louder than him. And he ended up with a full set of Sirwin Vega ER-124s. By that time, they had discontinued the paper surround on the speakers and went to an orange cloth surround. And it didn't have quite the same sound or projection. But, mm-hmm. You know, it was, you know, those guys would, you know, they take the backs off their cabinets. They would cut half the back off. And some of the cabs were closed back. Some of them were open back. And in the early days, I know Dickie and Duane used to, like, you know, trade cabinets and try different heads and stuff. They were always, you know, experimenting.
But I noticed, like, in especially the live album, the legendary one from the Fillmore.
Well, that's 250-watt Marshall bass heads with Duane.
Okay.
And probably a combination of Celestians and the Sirwin Vegas.
Okay, because their tone was a lot more mellower sounding, more the nice distortion,
yeah.
But it was a much like a, I would say that creamier sound, not the group Cream, but that
right.
That kind of really mellow bluesy type of sound, which, you know, the typical Marshall sound to me is like, you know, Rockin' the Fillmore Humble Pie, which was a 100-watt with a 4x12 cabinet straight out, but that was a much more mellower sound, and I would try it, I could not get that. I could get it easier on a Fender, but I didn't. It was harder to get that sound on a Marshall for me.
Well, keep in mind that all the early Marshalls were just basically a UK version of a Tweed Basement.
Mm-hmm.
And Dickie liked the lead heads because it was brighter, it cut through better. Duane liked the bass heads because it had a rounder sound. And he, I think Clapton had actually told him get the bass heads,
mm-hmm.
because they were darker and sounded more like the Basement.
Yeah, I think so. Even Hendrix used the bass heads.
He did.
Yeah.
But his were the early 100-watt ones with the KT-66 output valves.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And then also, too, you posted, if you go over on the Facebook page and look up Jack Weston, you'll see a picture he posted of the group playing. And there's been a lot of people going back and forth because it shows a bunch of the Sun amps.
And you're talking the Riverside shot.
Yeah, the Riverside shot. And
Riverside.
Check it out, because you'll see a stack of the Sun amps over by
Barry,
the bass player. And there's one sitting on top of one of the cabinets by Duane. And it has a little bit more knobs, and it looks like the guitar.
That's for Greg's Wurlitzer. That's the piano amp.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't used by Duane.
No.
Oh, okay.
I figured those four stacks by B.O. by Barry were all used by Barry for his bass setup.
Yeah,
right. Well,
that was very early.
B.O. could never have enough volume.
The Sun Coliseum did not exist yet, and I remember The Who used to use eight of those.
Yeah.
fully up. It was amazing.
But the other Sun rig was for Greg's Wurlitzer.
Oh, okay. So that was his. Oh, now we know the real story. But that's interesting. Now, before I go on, we got to talk more about the ants, but I want to digress real quick because Jack had mentioned something about Willie. That Willie, you also worked with Stevie Ray Vaughan. So I just wanted to get a little bit of insight. Any interesting things to talk about? Or I know you're not an equipment guy, but anything you can tell us?
Well, I can tell you how the relationship evolved. During the 80s, when the Allman Brothers had broken up for the second time, Greg Allman went out his solo Greg Allman Band, and he called me to come back to work for him. And I actually became the co-manager with Alex Hodges, who was
right.
an esteemed booking agent guy. And anyways, he was Stevie Ray's agent, and Stevie Ray sent him on a talent search to find him a new manager. And at the end of the search, Stevie Ray said, "Well, you know, everybody you brought me is good, but I think you're better, so why don't you be my manager?" And so that's how Stevie Ray came into the arrangement there. So we had a management company called Strike Force Management, and I spent most of my time, probably 90% of my time, with Greg. But on occasion, I would go out with Stevie, and he was, you know, a great guy, and he overcame a real bad personal problem with drugs, and he had turned his life around, and then he had that tragic accident when he left us far too soon.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, from walking behind the amp line at Stevie's show, it would almost knock you off your feet. With so
yeah. Well, was he another one that experimented with a lot of different amps? Was he using...
Yeah, all at the same time.
Yeah. I know he was one of the first guys to get the Dumbles. He was one of the earlier Dumble users.
But he'd have Marshall 200, Marshall Majors up there, along with a Plexi 100-watt head and Fenders. They had, like, a bunch of the Vibroverbs, and then he'd have, like, little Gibson amps.
Oh, okay. He was using the which Fenders? Did he use Supers? I thought he used Supers a lot.
He used Supers. He used the Vibroverb, the 115,
mm-hmm.
and he had a lot of different amps. I think he spent everything he made on sourcing out old amps and old Vibratone Leslie cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, that's right. I remember seeing that. Yeah, those were great.
Yeah,
the Leslie sound.
I've known Chris Layton since like 1975 when I lived in Corpus Christi,
mm-hmm.
and I still remember the day he came in. I was working doing guitar repairs part time at this music store, and he came in. "Hey, man, I'm going to move to Austin. What are you going to go up there for?" "Well, there's no blues scene here." I said, "Boy, you ain't kidding." Next thing you know, he's playing with Stevie.
You know? Okay.
Well, yeah, Chris is a great guy. Always loved him.
Well, getting back to the Allman Brothers, let me ask you, as a tour manager, I was shocked that they were making more. Obviously, those days the groups weren't making as much money as they were like later on in the 80s and stuff. That they actually had to take a loan and stuff. It's kind of interesting. How did you guys react? I mean, how did you handle as a tour manager? If, like, you know, obviously when they were touring and stuff, they must have been hitting pawn shops and looking for guitars, because there was such a, at that time, especially in those days in the early 70s, the pawn shops were rich with rare old guitars. So what happened? Did they have an expense account, or did they just ask you, or what did they, how would that happen?
Well, if it were a major expenditure, by this point they were you know, signed with Capricorn, and of course Phil Walden was the personal manager and the owner of Capricorn Records, and he probably advanced them $150,000 for, you know, everything, living expenses, equipment, flu shots, whatever, anything, until they got on their feet and started producing some income, and eventually of course paid him back and paid everything back. But you know, a lot of times people would show up at gigs with guitars and
yeah.
Dwayne would say, "Hey, I gotta have this, man." And you know, like $400-$700 was a huge expense for us in the early days, but we always found a way to get it. I never told Dwayne no.
He was a hard guy to say no to.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the weekend of that Fillmore recording, now he bought some guitars and guys drove all the way to Texas. Jack may be more
Kurt
Lenoff with this story. But he bought some guitars. I remember him coming down to the dressing room and saying, "You know, I need this money to get these guitars." I wrote him a check.
Did he use the new guitars in the recording, or did he stay with his staple guitar for the actual recording?
I think I don't think he used them on the recording. I think he, you know, had some work done on them before he used them. But I'm not 100% sure on that.
Now, I'm not sure about that time frame either. But he might have used that late '50s Cherry Burst. That, you know, that's the one where the neck was broken off, and they replaced it with a new neck, and so thus you couldn't trace it with a serial number, but they figure it was like a 59. That's Galadriel, his daughter's guitar, and it's at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now. I believe, was used on the... I don't know about that. I wasn't there. Willie can speak more about that, but certainly closed out the Fillmore, you know, on 6/27/71. We know that from photographs, but I can't speak for the March shows.
Well, the March shows, he had gotten the Cherry Burst in September of 70 and used that to finish the Layla track is when he first used that.
Maybe he did.
Yeah, the Dark Burst he got the closing weekend of the Fillmore, and Barry got a bass, and I think they got some like 410 bassmans and a couple other amps. But the Dark Burst is up at the Experience Music Project. Gladriel took it up there after the Beacon Run, you know, the
I saw it was up there. I believe I checked online. It's back at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, is it really? Okay.
In Cleveland now, I believe.
Now, his Dwayne's guitars, except for that neck being redone, and that's the one that Gibson has made a special.
Well, they've made copies of both of them.
So. But that guitar, electronically and everything else, besides the replaced neck, it was pretty stock, right?
No.
He didn't do any weird modifications, and neither did Dickey, right?
He liked the pickups that were in the gold top, so when he got the Cherry Burst, he had... probably Joe Dan and Dog take the pickups out of the gold top and put them in the Cherry Burst.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and the Dark Burst, I think Kurt Lenoff, who's the guy that found the guitar for him and drove it up to New York, Kurt actually swapped the neck and bridge pickup because the neck pickup was hotter. So he said, "Well, I'm going to put that in the bridge." So the bridge pickup originally had been in the neck, and the neck had originally been in the bridge. But Warren was telling me that there's something real special about that bridge pickup on that guitar. So,
and I presume those were all patent applied for, because those were old guitars.
Yeah.
Let's digress real quick and talk about, we can fill in the blanks with the Layla sessions. What was he using? Was he using that Cherry Burst Les Paul, or did he use anything else unusual? And what amps, or do we know?
Well, they Clapton had brought some Fender Champs, and they set them up in like those director's chairs, those camp chairs with the canvas back and bottom. And they used Champs on that. And Clapton had his Strats, but I think Dwayne just had the gold top.
He was using the gold top?
Yeah.
Because it's hard. The picture on the album, I think, is black and white, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah, he was using the 57 gold top, but Don, weren't those Champs like, what, 65s or 66s, something like that?
Yeah, they weren't, you know, they weren't the tweed ones, but, you know, the circuit, even in 65...
They're blackface.
Yeah. The blackface, the early blackface Champs weren't any different than the tweed. It was just a different cosmetics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yep.
So,
because it is a different sound. I mean, that whole album sounds different than the normal Dwayne, you know, the Allman Brothers sound. And, you know, so it had to be some different equipment in there. But that's interesting, though. But he used the gold top on that one then.
Yeah, until he came back to do the overdub at the end of Layla. And he had just gotten the Cherry Burst.
Oh, okay. So the overdub at the end is the Cherry Burst.
Right.
But the rest of it was the
gold top. Yeah.
Okay. Now, that's interesting. Very interesting.
Now, I want to know about this basement. Where did it Where did it disappear to all these decades?
Well, the Bassman was manufactured by Fender in September of 68. The band bought it from a company by the name of Lipham Music out of Gainesville, Florida, probably in March, maybe April of 69, along with other equipment. And it's the invoice is in our book. And so basically that's where that came into the fold. Two Bassmans were acquired, and they were 1968 Bassmans with basically the silver phase circuitry.
Right.
So it's a little bit different tone, and Don can tell you more about that, but it's a little bit different tone than the blackface setup.
Yeah,
right, Don?
They changed the bias circuit, and they changed the phase inverter circuit. So they were trying to make hi-fi amps out of them. You know?
Right. It's my understanding, I think I can, and maybe Skip can discuss this too, because he's a professional. I think you can only bias one tube on that, and the other one is averaged, right, Skip? Or can you explain how you bias that 68 silver face?
Well, that is true. Hi, everyone.
It's hi.
And I'm wowed by all this amazing Allman Brothers knowledge I'm hearing. And this is pretty arcane, but Don could tell you too. Yes, on that style amp, it would raise and lower each tube against the other one.
Right.
So the idea was to be able to balance the pair, but we nowadays we want to be able to balance the pair and also, you know, control the current in each one. So it's not the ideal setup. But I might also point out, I'm pretty sure that was an AB165 silver face basement circuit, which would be the same as a blackface one from year or so before. And it was all real stock. It hadn't really had any modifications or anything like that done to it when I saw it.
That's so more like the black. Yeah.
The early silver faces were pretty close to the black face. So
I think it was an AB165. Don would know that schematic, and I'm pretty sure that's the one that they used on. That's the one that was. And I thought the interesting thing was that it sat a long time, but it sure hadn't had much done to it. Mm. It didn't really need much to make it work again.
Oh, okay.
No! I think all you replaced were the power supply caps, everything underboard, everything else in the amp is original.
But wow. I thought that somebody had else tried to restore it or do stuff to it, and it kind of messed it up. Or am I wrong?
It never had been really touched. It never had been. All the active electronics on it were 100% original. When Skip got it.
It had been in a church at one point, right, Jack? Is that?
Yeah, it was in a church. What happened was, as we discussed earlier, you know, they started out with these silver faces, but ultimately they traded them in, likely on some more equipment and some other Marshalls. They traded it back to Lipham Music. And I talked to Buster Lipham, who was, his dad started the company and then he took it over.
Yeah.
But I talked to him about it probably 5 or 6 years ago, and he said ultimately it was traded back in. He can remember when it was traded back in, and they sold it to a church. And so it was used by a church for, you know, probably 35, 40 years or thereabouts, and
that's
then it
great.
Didn't work anymore. And they gave it to somebody that was in the congregation, just gave them the amp, and rather than throw it away, he drove up to Gainesville to a used guitar shop, and they put it up online for auction. It didn't sell initially, and, you know, ultimately I ended up buying it, but it was really, really close to ending up in a landfill.
Mm. Wow. Well, speaking of the amps, what happened to all the amps? Can you kind of go down the line of where everything went? I know that the Marshalls.
Oh, I think that's really hard. That's really hard to really trace that, because if you look at the Allman Brothers Museum in Macon, the Big House, it's called the Big House Museum. I mean, they've only got there's only three documented amps where they can 100% bona fide, you know, tie them into actually being used by the band through serial number. That's what you got to use, the serial number.
Yeah.
Dwayne Shulman amp was probably a 67, and that ended up being given after Dwayne passed by Greg to Ron Blair, who, as we all know, ended up being the bass player for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you look in our book, the Allman Brothers Band Classic Memorabilia, it's 69 to 76. If you look in there, you'll see the amplifier, and it's got stenciled on the top Heartbreakers. But Ron Blair was very gracious, and it's basically on, I believe, somewhat of a semi-permanent loan or you know, long term loan to the big house. It's been there since what, Willie? Probably about 2009 on display. Mm-hmm. That's the heartbreaker,
yeah. Yeah, and then at one point, Dickie's guitar tech, Jodan Petty, left the band to start his own band called Grinder Switch, which was on Capricorn, and he got a ton of equipment from the band. You know, they gave him a lot of hand-me-down stuff. I don't know exactly where all that went, and he's passed away now, too, so some of it got scattered to the winds. But, again, a lot of it was traded and new stuff bought for it and different music stores.
Derek's got.
I heard his son Jody Petty ended up with a lot of that gear, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh wow!
I heard that through the grapevine.
Now
I don't know if it's true or not.
Now, does Dickie still use a lot of the original amps, or he's using totally different stuff now?
I think Don could answer that question.
Well, he's using pretty much the same type of rigs that he's always used, the 100-watt Marshall with the 412 cabinets, but they're newer. He's not using ones from 69 or 70. I think I played through one of his rigs one time with Warren and J-Mo when they were doing sort of a sound check. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think the head was like a mid-70s 100-watt head.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay. Now, is he using different speakers, or is he using Celestians in there? Or is
no,
he,
he's got JBLs in him.
Still has the JBLs.
Well, not the D120s, but I think he's got like a K series, which or whatever the newer, the last version of the guitar speaker line, because they stopped making guitar speakers.
Right, right.
You know?
We're trying to get.
Hey,
them,
Don, this Jack. I got a quick question for you, just pertaining to that. In our book, we show Dwayne's Marshall head amplifier, which, you know, is currently owned by Derek Trucks.
Yeah.
And Derek took the photos and was gracious enough to let us use the photos in our book. What do you know? Can you tell by looking at the back of the electronics of that amplifier what model that is of Marshall? Do you know what? I'm assuming it's a 100 watt head, but I really don't know.
Well, let me see.
I thought it was a 50 watt head.
Dwayne always uses
it. It might be
50s.
A 50.
Yeah. If it's a 50, it's probably the base model, which is a 1986.
Yeah, it only has two of the big guys.
And there's only, like, between the lead model and the base model, there's only, like, three component differences. And that's just in the tone stack.
Okay.
Because I remember also, too, in Guitar Player, when Dwayne was interviewed, he mentioned he used a 50-watt, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, some of those early interviews.
It had a different sound. It broke up more. It had a much more...
It's a.
Can I just interject something, Skip? Could you educate us electronically what the tone stack is?
Sorry,
for the lay people.
well, basically, just the circuit that these individual amps use to control the treble, middle, and bass combination of capacitors and resistors is really all it is in this. In this whole primitive stuff, which is real simple classic circuits. But I would just throw out there that the base models and the lead models were just almost identical. It's those few little capacitors that Don mentioned, and they make a gigantic difference in the sound of the amp. You know, you just put this one little part in this one little spot, and it goes from being fairly warm and thick sounding to being what you might think of as more of a modern Marshall sound, just extremely bright and, you know, instantly really loud and punchy. So it's subtle differences with the basic circuit, but those little subtle differences can make a big difference in the sound of the amp. And you guys are talking a lot about how they got such a warm sound out of the Marshalls, and, you know, front pickups and turning down the guitars a little bit and not playing the brightest channel and just playing them in a more fatter, richer sound, and not what you think of as more of a 70s Marshall sound. It's monster.
I got another quick question, babe, before I forget. Were not the pickups back in those days overwound considerably more than they are today?
What difference does
that play?
Not
I'd be
really.
The wrong guy to ask, really, about
not really.
That.
Okay, Don?
They're pretty much the standard PAFs, which could range anywhere from like 7.2K up to like 9K. But I've got the specs for Dwayne's guitars for his pickups at home. I should have brought it with me.
But the PAF pickups had less output than later.
Than later, like DiMarzio Super Discars.
Yeah, they were, they're considered a lower output pickup. And
so you could overdrive more?
Not necessarily. They retain the clarity better when the amp is overdriven.
Yeah, you have more tone variance.
Okay,
yeah, you get more tone. Like if you use the two pickups together, that with the that type of sound, you'll get a nice. You'll get a much richer. There was much more variety in tone. A lot of guys after the Super Distortions came out, they went back to the lower output because they discovered that they could do more with it. Had more sound.
But we've got to throw out here. Skip says we have to throw out here that these guys were gods. And they could plug into a solid-state Standel backstage and play that like that, you know, because they just could.
Well, no, that,
now, of course, they liked the beautiful gear, and they were always, I'm sure they were always tinkering with it, like all of us were when we were in bands. But, oh, my goodness, just like Stevie Ray Vaughan can sound like that on an acoustic guitar with no amp.
Right. Yep. It's in it's in their hands, and yeah, it's. I mean, I've heard this story before that, like with Jeff Beck, you know, somebody went in the studio when he was doing Blow by Blow, and the Strat he had there was like just a, it was like trashed. It, you know, like somebody picked it up and tried to play, and it sounded terrible. And Beck, look at the album; it's legendary. Those are the guys. It's in their hands. They can play anything, and they sound like that. Yeah, and it's true. I know many players that I've seen them play, just walk in and sit in with a group with whatever the guitar is, and they still sound the same. It's in the hand. It's that magic.
I picked up Dickie's Gold Top one time into his 100-watt Marshall and flipped it on, and the sound was similar, but I don't have Dickie's fingers.
That's true. It's how the guy played, and his tone is just killer.
Your attack, how you touch the string, it's everything.
Yeah.
But they were looking for inspiration in the tone as well. And you give a pro a good amp, and even if he's the only guy that can hear the difference, well, that's all we need. And if it inspires him to play better, then it's a better amp for him.
Yeah, no, that's true. And also, too, when they play, you know, if you have the right, if you have good gear, it's easier to get there. You have to work a little harder if you're using subpar gear, but, you know, you can get it. It's like if you're good, you can get the sound. It's just it's a little easier to get some very interesting and cool tones when you have a nice vintage, you know. There's something to be said having a, you know, there's a reason why a Plexi Marshall is in demand, because it just gets that sound, and it's easier to get that sound with it. So, but.
Yeah, some of the best concerts I ever heard were Dwayne on one hotel bed and Dickie facing him on the other bed playing acoustics. A couple of beat up old acoustics.
Yeah.
And nobody had to pay a dime to hear it.
Did you ever find any records on what they used acoustic guitar wise? Because I noticed I didn't see any acoustics in the book. But
Dwayne had a Gibson besides his Dobro.
He had that that resonator, that wood Dobro that was used on a number of different albums, Layla being one.
But no, you hadn't heard anything about the other. I'm just curious what they used, like, you know, on the Eat a Peach and stuff like that, what they were playing.
I don't know what he used for.
I believe that Dobro, that resonator, was used on Little Martha. That's what I heard.
Little Martha, yeah, that was.
It was used on Eat a Peach, Little Martha.
And that's the one that Dickie has, right? Now?
Dickie has that.
Yes, Dickie. It's my understanding that Dickie owns that amplifier. I believe it was also used on the Layla Thorn Tree in the Garden. It was used on that, and I believe another tune on that LP.
Yeah.
I want to throw a question out to both Skip and Don about the. I want to talk a little bit about restoring these type of amps, and you know, when, like, I noticed I went on Skip's website, www.skipsimmonsamps.com, and there was this whole thing that you had written about recapping the amps. Now, I had talked when I talked to you before on the phone before the show. I had mentioned that I have a bunch of old Fenders, and they're over 40 years old, and I had to recap all of them. But you said in your article that that's not always necessary, that a lot of people tend to do that first and really don't. It can really ruin the sound. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Well, Don could tell you, if you change enough parts in a classic amp, eventually it starts to sound a little bit different.
Yeah.
But the way I approach it is when somebody calls me and says they have Dickie Betts Bassman, it's different, right? Everyone is different.
Yeah.
And our goal with that particular one was to see what we could make it do without changing anything, because we wanted it to be just like it was when he had it.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
a little different than if somebody was going to take it out on a world tour, or, you know, if you want it to sound like it did when it was new, you can't have bad parts in it. But it is amazing how well the Fender amplifiers in particular, and Marshall's slightly less, but Fender amplifiers especially, it's amazing how well they've held up. And I've serviced hundreds and hundreds, even back into the 50s, where the owner decided, no, it's fine, sounds great, we're running good, and it can be extremely original, and still, it's the design. It's not that I'm doing anything special to them. It's like an old Dodge Slant 6 engine. That thing's going to run, and you don't really need to change it. You just need to make it work like it did when it was new.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that doesn't take all that much. I've restored Fenders that have been buried in mud and water that have gone through Katrina.
Wow.
Hurricane Sandy,
yeah.
Tweed basement at my shop right now that was in a basement flooded with salt water and diesel oil. And it's going to work. I know it'll work.
But it stinks.
And
either
some parts
you mentioned
that are going to have to go, but a lot of times it's amazing what they can do. And I've done some service for some blues bands that have been playing their super reverbs for 20 years after I worked on them. And I know they're still super, super original. New power supply capacitors, like people
yeah.
know about, that's something that a lot of people are going to want to do. But if a part is still working good and not really bad, then it's optional, and it's kind of something I discuss with the owner, whether they want to start changing stuff or whether they just kind of like to run it. And a lot of enthusiasts like to just run it. And if the amps can sound great and still be real original, well, that's fun. And if
well,
somebody needs the thing to be completely brand new because it's their only amp and they're going on a big tour, well, that's a little bit
different thing, yeah.
a way to approach it.
Well, let me.
It's funny you mentioned the Dodge Slant 6 engine. That the Allman Brothers' first equipment truck was a retired Avis rental truck. Probably had 200,000 miles on it when we got it, and it had that engine in it. And that thing went all over the country for another 150,000 miles or so before we finally
yeah.
had to get rid of it.
It's like the Fender, you know, it wasn't working that hard. Those things are a big block, and it's a pretty
yeah.
good size displacement, and it's a big, heavy crankshaft in
I'm
that
sure
engine.
I'm sure 70 miles
an
hour
loafing.
Just floated along, you know?
Well, yeah, it's kind of loafing, and a Fender amp, you could turn it on and leave it on for days,
yeah.
and it
yeah.
won't blow up or anything. It's just, they run fairly conservatively.
You know, there's one thing I want to interject about the Fenders. If you turn the amp on, it gets used, you know, every week for a few hours, it's going to run for a long time. But if you store them somewhere, then those
yep.
electrolytics dry out.
Yeah.
Yep.
That Slant
yeah.
6 won't start if you leave it for a year, right?
Yeah. Good enough.
You got to go out there and run to the store every so often and yeah. keep it going.
Well, let me
doesn't that pertain skip to the dielectric? I mean, you know, it's
yeah.
like Don was alluding to or discussing there, the more you use them, the better. I mean, you don't want to let them
mm-hmm.
lay
yeah,
fallow for a long time, or they'll, like you said, they'll dry out. But
yeah.
what I do is whether I'm going to use Dickie's amp or not, and more times I don't use it, but occasionally I do. But sometimes when it's just been sitting for a month, I will go down in my sound room and I'll turn it on and I'll leave it on for about a half hour, and then
yeah.
you know, so I exercise those especially those paper caps on the underside and try to keep the dielectrics you know functional.
I say yes.
Yes.
They're like a battery and they can go bad in a flashlight and turn to crap, you know, but if you use them more regularly and keep those things nice and warm, then they can last an amazingly long time.
So every couple of months, if you're not using the amp, you should just turn it on, like on standby?
No, you have to have it on. You turn it
totally
on standby.
On. Yeah.
The
high
thanks,
voltage
guys.
Isn't
yeah,
getting...
Thanks for saying that. I'm glad I
sorry.
Didn't have
no,
to.
No, because I don't always use my Fenders.
Yeah, get that thing on.
I'm going to have to go home tonight and turn all my amps on now.
Well, that'll probably heat your house up. You won't have to worry about
that's true. It's cold. It's cold here. So, yes, it would be a good thing. Let me ask a question. I want to direct this to Don and Skip. In terms of the design of the amp, what's the and you can confirm or deny this. What's the most critical part of the that it determines the sound of it? I've heard that one things is the power supply. If you change the power supply, if you have to replace it, that can radically change the sound. And besides the power tubes, could you guys give me your impressions, both of you, either one?
Don first. I'm thinking.
Yeah. voltage is a weird animal. The higher the voltage in a guitar amp, usually the more headroom you've got, the clearer it stays before it starts to break up. A lot of those old amps didn't have terribly high output voltages coming out of the rectifier. What a rectifier does is it changes AC voltage from the power transformer to DC voltage for the amp to be able to use. Signal is always AC. The voltage, the operating voltage is always DC.
Right.
So, the quality of the parts that you use too.
Right. Well, I'm just wondering because like a lot of the vintage amps, some of those old transformers, the newer ones, you know, they're different. They're not.
Well, the iron laminations are a different material than they used to be. You got all these great, wonderful, you know, silicone impregnated iron laminations that just, you know, frequency wise is through the roof. Those old transformers had, you know, low grade to medium grade iron laminations.
Mm-hmm.
And the copper wire, some guys say, well, there was a higher silver content in the copper back then. And, you know, I'm just like, what? You know, it's just.
But do you find that the newer power supplies, are they performing as, I mean, do they sound as good as the, or help the sound for the newer? Is there good stuff out there?
There's good stuff out there, yeah.
So, because I know that when I had mine recapped, they could get close to what the original caps are, but they're gone. I mean, the originals, they're not the same.
The Germans and the Czechs make some very good electrolytic capacitors under the JJ and F&T brand. Mercury Magnetics makes excellent transformers. Unfortunately, all the Schumacher transformers that everybody that Fender used to use are only made in China now. So
yeah,
they're not the same quality.
I think my caps were the JJs. So they were using the JJs.
Yeah, those are good. Most of the Marshalls used LCRs or Eries, and neither of those companies make caps anymore. But there again, the JJs and the F&Ts do that are good quality. You can't boil down a great sounding amp to one particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a combination. It's like anything. It's a combination.
Well, I'm looking in terms of if you get an old, you have an old amp and you need to restore it, how much should you do? How much you shouldn't do?
Well, I wouldn't change anything in the signal path unless the component has drifted so far out of spec that it needs to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, sometimes a little, you know, mismatch or out of spec can be a wonderful thing tonally.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. A lot of those amps, there were mistakes, and they actually worked.
Yeah,
you know, that's you. Skip, did you get a chance to think?
I'd say we're just lucky because all these options you guys are discussing just didn't exist a few years ago.
Right.
Something I'll throw out is vacuum tubes were just gone, and then within just a few years, everybody wanted them again.
Yeah,
and now tube amplifiers, you can go into a guitar center and three-quarters of the guitar amplifiers in the place, even the ones that are $99, they have a tube in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole tube thing has exploded, and now here we are crying, which speaker is best? Don will tell you, it wasn't long ago when you just couldn't find hardly anything for parts, capacitors, speakers, and now we're lucky. We have a whole bunch of new choices that we can use when we're building new amps or when we're restoring old amps. I'll throw out a little cheat here is I buy from old junk dealers old electronics.
There you go.
So that when I get a, when I need a 1 meg Allen Bradley carbon comp resistor for some old Fender, I go find an exactly the same one from something from 1955, right?
No,
but
yeah.
Not every, you know, a manufacturer doesn't have that luxury, but a guy that's just doing it one at a time can often find quite a few actual real parts, the exact thing if he mm-hmm. needs it.
Yeah. There's a few electronics surplus places around town here, and I would imagine up in the Sacramento area there are too, but
right.
You know?
Yeah, I like old organs and consoles that are actual mm-hmm. pieces of, like, you know, the surplus places are almost all full of computer stuff these days. But, you know, old parts, there are some available, and there's some actual parts that were used in Fenders that weren't used only in Fenders. You know, you're not going right. to find a knob that they only used on blackface amps on a piece of test equipment, that you might find the exact same tube or a little disc capacitor or a little resistor that's the exact same part. Yeah. And again, we're just lucky we have a lot of choices, and my goal usually is to try to make it sound as much like the original thing as possible.
Right.
That's
yeah.
what I'm generally doing for most of my customers.
So I just like to interject this, Jack. I just like to interject one thing on Dickie's 68 Bassman.
Yeah.
Another place to find good parts is, guess what? Google. I Googled, and when I first got that amplifier, it had a set of brand new groove tubes in it. And the first thing I wanted to do is and this is before Skip ended up with the head.
Yeah.
I wanted to find a match pair of 6L6 Fenders, Fender brand, 1960s. And I Googled, and I was able to find a guy in Texas that had some, and I got a pretty fair price from him on them, and I think it was like $250.
Yep.
I got a match set of with very low hours. I tested the tubes on my tube tester using transconductance. You know, they looked really good to me as far as how they outputted. I'm pretty confident, and Skip verified that they were pretty much well matched.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're restoring these old amplifiers, and if you don't have some of the original tubes in the, you know, in the phase, you know, in the input stage or the phase inverter stage or in the output stage, man, if you can find the original vintage tubes that are matched, you know, especially it's critical in the output stage, of course.
Yeah.
It makes a big, big, big difference.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, we're out of time. I told you it'd go by fast.
I got 10 till. Come on.
No, that's what I got. They're got to set up for the next show.
You said 10 minutes.
Don, we talked about this. It's going to zip by, right?
Yes.
I told you.
No. He's been on before, so he knows. Anyway.
He knows the drill.
The name of the book is The Allman Brothers Band, Classic Memorabilia, 1969 to 1976, written by Willie Perkins and Jack Weston. I want to thank you guys for being on the show. This is a killer book. It's great. And we just talked about the amps, but if you're into the Allman Brothers, there's all this other stuff in there about.
Oh, gosh. It covers T-shirts, passes, posters, handbills, programs, concert tickets, pendants, promotional items. We got about 35, most of them never published, photographs. And then we have many of Willie's ledgers, receipts, contracts, mm-hmm. and checks that he wrote out to the band and for other functions, and then there's a miscellaneous section. So it's just packed with a whole bunch of different categories of memorabilia. It's just it's pretty mind-boggling all the things that are in there.
And it's published.
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble, or if you look Jack and I up on Facebook, you can get a signed inscribed copy from us direct by mail.
Okay.
So it's out there.
And also,
the publisher tells us they're going to a second printing already.
Yeah, congratulations. And then it's also, you can check out www.AllmanBrothersBand.com. There's a thing on how to order it there, too. So, but it's
correct.
Out now, right? So everybody
yes.
can get it, because people have been
yep.
responding on Facebook asking where they can get the book. And it's published by Mercer University Press, Macon, Georgia. So, Willie, thank you very much. Jack, Willie and Jack are both on Facebook. Check them out. Skip, www.skipsimmonsamps.com. And one of the few people I would trust a Fender, one of my Fenders with, for sure. And
well, then, I was honored to be asked to work on that neat thing.
Well, you know,
so I heard a lot of expertise tonight. I wouldn't hesitate to let you guys work on anything I own.
Thank you.
But anyway, maybe some of your cars, Willie?
Yeah.
Maybe so.
Got a slant.
Got a hood ornament for a 37 Buick.
And Don.
Hey, it's been an honor being on your program, Jeff.
Thank you so much.
And Don and Skip and Willie, it's just been an honor for us to participate.
An honor for me, too.
Absolutely.
And I just want to throw out thetoneman.com for Don. And Don does amps, too, but he also does pedals. He's worked on my pedals, and he does guitars and all sorts of stuff. And besides that, he's a killer player. And he brought in a Les Paul. We took a picture of it. I'll post it up there. It's a beautiful guitar. Everybody, hang on. I'll talk to you really quick after the exit music. Everybody else, have a great week. I will see you next week, and just have a good one, and check out this book. It's really good.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take care.
Thanks, everybody.